The time is 1:44. Date is the 14th of April, 1983. The place is room 124, the judiciary hearing room in the Capitol building located in Juneau, Alaska. Present for the hearing today are Representative Liska, Representative Hayes, Representative Clarkson, and myself, Representative Bussell. The matter at issue today is committee substitute for House Bill 6, State Affairs, which is an act relating to driving a motor vehicle. The committee has held hearings on this bill before. At that time, there were some changes that were going to be worked into some subsequent testimony, which we're about to begin today. But before I begin to take that testimony, I'd like to take just a moment to recognize the students that are visiting us today. And I understand that it's the Juneau Elks Club annual visitation by students from across the state. And if I could take just a minute, I'd like to start in the back row here and have you stand and say your name and where you're from, please, and kind of go down the line.
Tim Obendorf from Slobodna.
Carla Johnson from Rain.
Rita Rogan from Palmer.
Scott Reed from Cordova.
Brandon Jones from Cordia.
And are you the chaperone today?
Would you believe my name tag says co-warden?
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm just one of the parents that are carrying the children around the state government.
So where are you from?
I'm from Juneau.
Oh, you're from here. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, welcome to the judiciary hearing today. The matter at issue today is one that's had a lot of publicity lately, and I suspect that all of you present are aware of what it is. Since we do have the prime sponsor at the table, Representative Booth, before you may proceed with the statement, as you will, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Mitchell Booth. I'm the sponsor of the House Bill 6. I'd like to just say briefly that the purpose and the intent of House Bill 6 is to address the problems of drunk drivers. We could take the bill and we could put in there about automobiles in some respects. An automobile does not get drunk. A driver gets drunk. The car kills in one way, but it's the driver who's responsible for that. We can't hang a car, we can't electrocute a car, we can, or a gun, we can, in other circumstances, do something with the driver or the user of that. I guess what I'm really trying to say, Mr. Chairman, is I'd be very unhappy if we were to take into consideration, even though it must be addressed, the rehabilitation of those addicted to alcohol. We're dealing with a driver. We're dealing with one who does not have the responsibility of drinking and driving. I'd like to see this bill kept as clean as we possibly can, concerning itself only with the drunk driver and not the rehabilitation of that driver, even though that's probably one of the biggest things the state is faced with today, and tremendous amounts of money go to it. I'll direct myself now to House Bill 6. There are some changes. There will be a committee substitute, which will be brought in front of this committee Monday. We did not have time to do it. We did make some changes in it. I will very briefly go over those changes, and then I would like to defer to Council Gail Goretzky to give an explanation of it if necessary, and for questioning. On the license suspensions, revocations, and limitations, we have changed it to the licenses revoked for 90 days. However, the first 30 days will be without limited license privileges. The other 60 days will be with limited license privileges. And that is, it's revoked if they haven't had an occasion to be arrested or convicted within 15 years. The second offense, the license is revoked for 1 year, no limited license privileges, within 15 years. More than two offenses, the license is revoked for 10 years versus permanent. Driving while license is canceled. Now, let me point out one thing to make it very, very clear, that we're only talking about DWIs. We're not talking about the guy that was speeding and got his, when he had his license revoked or suspended or revoked. Only pertaining to the deed caught and does these things when he's been arrested for the DWI on this charge. There's nothing to do with anything else. Under the license cancel, suspended, revoked in violation of the limitation, the sentence is not less than 10 days, which is the present law, for those other than DWI. DWI is 30 days. Second offense, 90 days. Fine, not less than $500.
I'm sure I understand what you're saying. You're proposing a couple of changes to the provision then that creates penalties for driving with a suspended license. What you're saying, first of all, is that the person who's caught driving with a suspended license who is not a DWI gets the existing penalty.
True.
The person who's caught driving with a suspended license because of a DWI will get 30 days for a first offense. What was it, 60 days for the second offense?
90 days.
90 days for the second offense.
Okay. Nothing has changed in the first offense. It's still 72 consecutive hours. However, the fines, we've done something with the fines. First offense, second offense, more than two offenses. We've left the fines $250, $500, and $1,000 as we had. However, we're taking the top limits off. There's no limit to the amount of the fee. We leave that to the discretion of the jury, the judges, the courts.
Okay, so if I may, just so I understand, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The minimum fine, first offense,
$250, second $5,
and no maximums at all.
No max on any of them. More than two, $1,000. Giving the point, if I might add, that with the first offense, I was going to raise that to $500. But then somebody had told me about the little children that may not be getting any food because the father went out and got drunk and got to pay $500 for the fine. So we kept it down at $250, figured he can afford that, or at least he can go out and get the money, and therefore the children will go hungry. Under vehicle impoundment, we have deleted the impoundment section altogether. We're taking a look at the example of the city of Anchorage having a great deal of problem with the making the problem or the impoundment stick, number one. Number two, I don't think we've got land large enough to hold impoundment vehicles, and the administrative procedures and problems that we'd have would be absolutely humongous. So we've deleted that. Forfeiture stands. Humongous is H-O-M while you figure it out. It's actually H-U-M something, I guess. Comes from the derivative of huge. Forfeiture section, we're leaving that as is because that is something that we're doing now in fish and game and in drug enforcement. It's in the drug laws and so on. We feel that is a defensible situation.
Excuse me, leaving it the way it was in the state affairs version of the bill?
That's a change, yes. We are going to leave in the forfeiture section. I see nothing further, any further changes in it at this point in time, except some perhaps language changes, and that's precisely why counsel is here and Gail is here to explain any language changes and further to go into any of the further questions you would like to ask regarding some of these changes. Again, it will be in front of you again on Monday. Hopefully, if Dale can rally with round the flag, I suppose, and we may have it. Is that true, Dale? Again, Mr. Chairman, thank you much for allowing me to say a few words. I hope I haven't preempted my counsel on it, because she's far more intelligent at this than I am. So,
thank
Mr.
you.
Speaker, I'd like to defer to Councilor.
Thank you, Representative.
Well, it's just one particular policy question that I think
President
maybe would be better able to answer. I realize that you don't want to address the question of rehabilitation here, but there was testimony at the earlier hearing, you recall, about the ASAP program, the Alcohol Safety Action Program. A proposal that be one proposal that it be made mandatory, and second proposal that the suspension of license provision be tied to whether or not they go through an ASAP program. That is, a longer suspension of license if they don't go through the program, and a shorter suspension of license if they do go through the program. I know that you have proposed changes which would basically allow a limited license. It seems to me that a good argument could be made that you should. It's a carrot and stick argument, that if you go through the ASAP program, your penalty isn't going to be as high. I'd just like to ask you whether or not that's
reasonable. I need to interpret that. We got that. I think you're drawing the conclusion that we rendered felonious as we went along. The ASAP program, he tried to state, wasn't that they didn't send them all to it, but the law does say that he must go to it if it's available. The present law. It's not a choice. The judge must add that to the sentence. It's in present statute.
Yeah, I think we got testimony that wasn't in fact what was happening.
If it's available, it's there. It just isn't available all the time.
Yeah.
So your question is really not wrong.
It does relate to the question of suspension of license. I mean, if you successfully complete an ASAP course, should the suspension be a shorter period, because that's the carrot? That's what urges you to straighten your life out when you get your license.
My personal philosophy is that I give nobody any carrots for doing a good job. They do if they haven't committed anything wrong. These people have committed something wrong. I don't feel we should reward them for going through something that they should have probably gone through on their own hook. Secondly, if we've got the facilities to handle what you speak of now, Representative Clarkson, I'm all for. I have never been against rehabilitation. But if we come in with these laws here and we get those drunk drivers off the streets, which is exactly what we want to do, then maybe that'll throw the carrot out to somebody to say, wait a minute, let's put these people in minimum security so we can get our hands on them for the minimum sentence that they've got to go. And first of all, you know very well it takes 10 days or better to detox somebody. You can find those statistics at the hospital. At least if we've got them someplace and get our hands on them, we can keep them off the booze, and then they start to be able to think, perhaps. Maybe we can get something through with our rehabilitation programs. But I don't feel that we should, because he's going to go through this thing, he's going to get a reduced sentence or something of that nature. I want the sentence to be full, so that when he does go through it, and he does have the full sentence, he'll say, wow, I can tell you I'm not going to do this again. Mm-hmm. That's where I want the thing to come from. That is a deterrent, if you will. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying there, but I don't want to reduce the minimums on this thing just to get him to go through a program. It's law now that he must go through it. If he doesn't understand or want it to take to him, then he better stay right in there and hang. He's going to have to stay there anyway. That's all I'm saying.
Just one other thing, and let me say that the amendments, as you indicated before the hearing started, would get us a lot closer together on agreeing with it. I think some of them are excellent amendments.
Don't worry about that, Mr. Clarkson.
Yeah, I know. If I agree with it, you won't. That's the danger. But let me just say, on the question of rehabilitation, I continue to believe that those questions are closely tied, because I believe, based on statistics and instinct as well, that for the alcoholic, that person is going to find a way, one way or the other, to get back on the street, whether he's going to have to drive with somebody else's car, or if he's going to drive without a license or whatever, he's going to drive again, and he's going to drive drunk again until we attempt to deal with his alcoholism. And therefore, I think rehabilitation is inextricably tied to the goal you have of getting him off the street. You stated your position on that clearly, but I just want to say that.
Well, I understand, sir, and I'm not going to address rehabilitation. I figure if he does it again, he's going in for 10 or 20 days, which is 13 days longer, 17 days longer than he went in the first time. If he goes in there more too, he's going to do 30 days, and we're going to keep upping it until he's in there forever. That way we know he's not driving the car on the street.
But you aren't going to keep him in there forever. Keep him in 30 days or 90
next year
days
I'll pass another
year.
Bill and take care of that.
Thank you, Representative Lou.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, it's always our pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, sir.
But since we are recording electronically, I have to ask you to say your name again before you proceed to the stand.
Of course, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm here to comment on the technical aspect of CSHB6 State Affairs, which the Judiciary Committee has in front of it. I would echo the remarks that Representative Boot just made, that the Criminal Division of the Department of Law has been working with Representative Abood and with his aide on a proposed committee substitute to present to this committee for its possible adoption in substitution for the committee substitute which came from State Affairs. Let me make it very clear that the policy questions obviously are for this committee to make, and in terms of the number of days and the penalties, that is totally up to this committee and to ultimately the legislature, and the Department of Law doesn't take a position on a specific number of days or a specific fine. What I have been asked to do and what I've been very glad to do is take the present bill and look at it in terms of form making suggestions for ease of enforcement and how in fact it can be approved so that it will withstand any possible court challenge which might appear. With that introduction, let me alert the committee to the changes which are proposed, and then if there are any questions, perhaps we could address them so that when the committee substitute comes before you, we'll have worked out some of these bugs.
Oh, okay. I want you to know that we don't have a
committee substitute. Right, I understand that.
And you apparently been working on
it. We have a draft of it, but it's not finalized, which was, okay. I understand, partially the reason for this meeting.
Can we just wait a minute?
Yes, sir.
I think I've overlooked something. I just noticed that there are three young people over here. Are these young people? Yeah. Oh, they're not. Thank you. I see you. I thought maybe I had overlooked part of your group and I was feeling bad about it. But Jerry, you're here to testify, right? Good. Thank you.
Referring you to the present copy of the bill, I guess maybe I should look at the copy that you have.
State Affairs?
The State Affairs version. Section 3, the current version of
okay. I don't have it in my file.
Section 3?
No.
I'm going to have it. I have two files.
I'd like to alert the committee to a problem with the current bill, which a parent problem which we've discovered and how we propose to cure it. A little bit of history. Before the DWI laws were amended last session in 1982, which took effect in October of 82, there was a provision under 2815-181 which stated a court revoking a person for given offenses, and then the offenses were listed, and they are such offenses as manslaughter, perjury in relation to applying for a license, using a car as a getaway vehicle in a felony offense, DWI, reckless driving. There were five or six different offenses for which a person's license could be suspended. And if a person was convicted a second time for any of those offenses, then he was subject to the mandatory penalty of 1 year for second conviction, 3 years for third conviction. What happened last session was that the legislature pulled out the DWI offenses and stiffened the penalties for license revocations for DWIs only, saying it was 60 days for the first offense instead of 30 if a limited license was given. And that's fine. We understand the reason behind that. What happened, however, is you lost that sort of mix and match aspect. So under the current law right now, a person, say, for example, in 1980 was convicted for manslaughter or for some serious offense, reckless driving that resulted in injury, something of that nature. And then this year, he was convicted of DWI. Well, under the way the law is written right now, that DWI would be considered a first offense for purposes of the license suspension under 2815-181, because that's under subsection B and the other is under subsection A, and the two do not interrelate any longer. So what we are proposing to do is to amend the provision back to how it used to read, where you have this sort of, I call it mix and match. I hope you understand what I mean by that, but those are not the statutory terms. And but also incorporating, as Representative Booth has indicated, the higher penalties for license suspension if you're talking about DWI. We're keeping the higher penalties for DWI offense, but we're also allowing that they will count as a second or third offense if there was a prior reckless driving, for example, or a prior manslaughter conviction involving a motor vehicle. Under your current Section 3 of the bill,
can I interrupt there? Or do you
yes,
want to
sir.
Go through
it's fine.
I just want to make sure I don't have something in front of me to read, so I want to make sure what you're saying. What
mm-hmm.
you are saying, the bill that we will see on Monday will basically have three levels of punishment then for driving with a suspended license. The first category would be those less important things like driving when you had your license suspended because of failure to have insurance. And that would be the existing law of 10 days. And then it would be, if you're 30 days for a DWI and a year for manslaughter. Is that?
No. These are not penalties for DWLS. They're penalties that you get for being convicted for the underlying substantive crime. For example, if you get convicted of reckless driving and it's your first offense, you lose your license for 30 days. Okay. If you get convicted for DWI and it's your second offense, counting reckless as first, you face a mandatory license suspension of 1 year. Okay. All of those things will mix and match under one section. There will be a separate section that deals with DWI offenses, successive ones, which carry higher penalties, that the two will mix and match, so that you can have your first be a reckless and your second be a DWI. But if you have two or three DWIs in a row, you're going to end up with a higher sentence in terms of license suspension. This is not a DWLS provision. It's for the substantive offense. Okay. The current Section 3 is talking about the license suspension for DWI, and it's 90 days now in your version, 1 year permanent. And as the representative indicated, we kept it 90 days but allowed a limited license after 30. 1 year is kept, and then the permanent has been changed to 10 years. The feeling on that was that 10 years, of course, is a very severe sentence, and especially if it was a young person and he or she lost his license, say, permanently at age 20 or 25, that was a disproportionate penalty. Even though, not to minimize the seriousness of the offense, that a permanent revocation with no hope of ever getting your license back in some circumstances might work a great injustice. So that was the reason for the substitution of 10 years. The other change is the addition of a 15-year window, if you will, during which these offenses are counted. So if somebody was convicted back in 1957 and then convicted back in 1980, you don't go back to the 57 conviction, he's treated as a first offender. And that, I suppose, is some recognition that if a person keeps those things for long enough, he should get some credit for the fact he's been law-abiding in the interim. I should note that that's a concept that's included in the felony piece of the sentencing scheme. 7 years after unconditional discharge of a felony, that is no longer considered to be a prior offense. So that kind of a framework is not unheard of. It's in the current law now for jail sentences, and it's now 5 years. That's been changed in this bill to 15 in line with the license suspension stuff. Any questions about that? I'm only trying to mention things that the representative did not mention, because there's no need to obviously duplicate. One thing that he didn't mention about the fine, and this is in the version of your bill, in section 8 begins on the bottom of page 4 and goes to page 5. In addition to deleting the top amount, I would like to mention that the representative indicated there was no specified top amount. That's true. It's not specified in the bill, but all of these offenses are denoted as Class A misdemeanors, so your top amount is $5,000. Although it doesn't say that, the judge could never go beyond the $5,000 limit. The other change that has been made, the representative didn't mention, was that the court is not allowed to suspend payment on the minimum portion of the fine. Let me just explain that. For example, if it's a first offense and the court would be free to give a specific defendant, for example, a $500 fine, he could suspend $250 of that fine on various conditions, such as treatment or no similar violations for a certain period of years, restitution if there was an injury. So he could suspend the $250 of the $500 as long as the defendant was required to pay the basic minimum amount stated in the statute, which for first offense is $250. So the fines can go higher, but and a portion, if they go higher, a portion can be suspended, but no portion below that minimum amount can be suspended. And the minimum amounts are $250, $500, and $1,000 for a first, second, and third offense. Any reference to a suspension of the license throughout the bill has been deleted, because in the DWI section, if you're convicted, what will happen is that your license will be revoked. For most purposes, that's exactly the same. What it accomplishes, a revocation other than a suspension requires the person to reapply to get a license back, which means that DMV can re-examine them if they think it's appropriate, and there are the requirements that the person be able to show financial responsibility to get his license back. Suspension, once it's over, you automatically get the license back. There's no need to reapply, etc. And it was felt that a revocation was a more appropriate procedural way to take the license away than a suspension. So throughout, references to suspension have been deleted.
What that means is that any time you talk about suspending the license, it's actually revoked.
Yeah, it's actually
and they're going to have to apply to have it reissued.
Right.
It doesn't happen automatically.
It doesn't happen
automatically.
In
all cases.
In all DWI cases.
Right.
Or refusal to take a breathalyzer cases. They're treated the same. On the administrative suspension, the way the bill is written right now is if a person refuses to take a breathalyzer, the officer takes his license right at the time and then hands him a temporary license. And unless the person files a notice in district court, that temporary license will expire at 7 days, and the person then, his license is revoked. The present bill requires DMV to notify the person that DMV is going to take the person's license, revoke the person's license. Well, the officer has already notified him that when he gave him the little green slip at the time that he took the license. So actually the bill requires a dual notification, one of them by DMV by mail, and that gets you into the problems under the current law, which is proving that notice in fact reached a person, such as who signed the certified receipt and what if they moved, that sort of thing. So the requirement that DMV notify the person who's already received in-person notice has been deleted, and it's been changed to just say the Department of Motor Vehicles shall revoke the license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when you talk a little bit about suspension, mm-hmm. Do you know how it works actually from a practical viewpoint now if a license is suspended, say for 30 days, and it's turned in to the DMV? Does the DMV then send it back, or do they still have to apply?
They have they have to go down and physically get a new license and pay $5 and get it.
So in no way is a license automatically revived. The person still has to make application for a new license, whether revoked or suspended. Is that not true?
Well, no, not really, sir, Mr. Chairman, if I may, because it's an automatic procedure to get it back if something gets suspended. If it has been revoked, you have to reapply. They can make you take the driving test again if they think you should.
Excuse me, does DMV just hold the license then to return to them, or?
No, it's destroyed, and they're given a new, because they have to take their picture over again and type their name in.
They really have to go through some form to get a new license physically.
But one is an automatic. All they do is go down and pay the $5 and get it, and the other is a reapplication procedure.
Further testing, et cetera.
Yeah. One is sort of akin to if you lose your license and then you go down and say, I lost my license, they automatically give you a new one. They don't make you take the road test or anything. That's the suspension type procedure.
One of the worst punishments I can think for anybody is to make them go through the waiting lines at the Anchorage driver's license place.
I think that's
an additional penalty that we're imposing.
And if I can slip in a personal comment, especially when you have to take off of work to do it because they're not open late in the evening or on Saturday. That's
right.
Always been
hopefully the budget will take care of
pet
that.
Pet peeves on that. Okay. There are some language changes which really are not crucial, so I'm just kind of skipping over here. Let me just expand upon the fact that we have been in contact with the Anchorage prosecutor, Mr. Bailey, and they do have it, as I'm sure the committee members are aware, a forfeiture and impoundment provision, which is very similar to the one that appears in HB 6. Because of the procedural problems which the Anchorage municipality has experienced in enforcing that law, and in fact it's been in effect since November, and the very first car that was taken away here just about a week ago, so we're several months later that they've taken their first one, and that was a forfeiture, not an impoundment. We are, at this point at least, deleting the impoundment provision because the enforcement problems on that were really very great. Under the bill as it's currently written, a person is entitled to a hearing under, it's cross-reference to a hearing under, let's see what's in. I don't have the site in front of me, but it's cross-reference to a section of the Title 28, which really deals with hearings for license suspensions, and it requires all kinds of written notice and a certain number of days to expire. I think it was 10 days. And actually, the two sections were contradictory. It required a hearing on the impoundment or the release within 15 days, and the other statute required 10 days' notice before you could hold the hearing. So you would never have a hearing on the impoundment before the impoundment was expired, which really doesn't make any sense to me. So that has been deleted, and the forfeiture section will be changed slightly. The representative stated that would remain the same. What he meant is that concept will remain in there. It's going to be redrawn to more closely track the provisions of the drug bill, which talk about notice to innocent security holders, and also to make it clear that the way it will work is a DA upon a multiple offender, a third or more offender, will motion the court following the conviction to forfeit the motor vehicle. That way the DA will have had a chance ahead of time to, one, establish who has title to that vehicle, two, get the papers from the bank if they have to do that, to show who's got title. Only use this as a very potent sanction in those cases where the driver really needs to have his car taken because he's shown through repeated instances of drunk driving that he is just not responsible. For example, the gentleman who lost his vehicle in the first one that they just recently did in Anchorage was convicted for 5 DWIs in 1 year period. I don't think there's anybody here who wouldn't agree that that's just outrageous conduct. And evidently, none of the previous sentences or the threat of future sentences was sufficient to deter that man from continuing to drink and drive. So the court at that point says, well, sufficient showing has been made that he should not be driving, and in addition to sentencing the man to a year and a half in jail, also forfeited his vehicle. What we envision is that this discretionary forfeiture in the discretion of the court following a motion by the district attorney or the municipal prosecutor would work much the same way. and that it wouldn't be automatic. It would be a sanction that would be sought by the district attorney in appropriate cases, i.e. where the facts are just really egregious, and where the DA can find the evidentiary proof necessary to establish that that is the person's car, that he owns it, that there are no innocent parties, and that it ought to be forfeited. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer.
Any proxy?
We're operating at a disadvantage because we don't have the bill in front of us. Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying, what Representative Boone is saying. This bill will not provide for any impoundment or seizure of a vehicle prior to conviction.
That's right.
The only provisions are those, roughly those currently on the books with regard to forfeiture after conviction?
Well, right now, if you're speaking of state law, there are no provisions on the books regarding forfeiture of motor vehicles following conviction.
Okay, so you're adding a procedure where it can be forfeited after conviction?
After a third or more.
Third or more.
Yes. That is on the books only in Anchorage municipal ordinances. That's, we can't even find other states that have got a provision like that. I think we're on the forefront of that.
Are you going to change that language much? It looks to me like that begins on page 15 on line 4, that forfeiture thing. That'll stay about the same. What he's taken out is on line 13, section 15, he said, I guess. 18 is taking out that impoundment section, which runs clear over to the top of page 15, right?
Right. That is exactly deleted.
Leaving the forfeiture thing in.
Yes. Leave it in, but we're going to change it a little bit. The wording of this one has not been drawn up. The wording of the other changes has been drawn up. This one has not been drawn up. So we were consulting with Mr. Bailey about the best way to do that. So the language may be changed somewhat. I know it'll be moved up in the bill because there are other sections taken out.
I have a long letter somewhere from Mr. Bailey. I see the sworn Virginia, but I don't see it. It has to do with that forfeiture. Representative Westfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. JO1, this $250 fine here. Now, this just mandatory that the judge has to impose that?
Yes,
that's
sir.
A presumptive fine.
Please don't call it presumptive because you'll mix it up with presumptive sentencing, which is a whole different deal.
That's mandatory.
Yes, sir. And again, this is a policy question for the committee. I'm just telling you that how it's being drawn to make sure that the language will work well if it needs to be enforced by the DA's office.
Well, I'd like to ask one more question. Now, Representative Booth mentioned that he backed off of the $500 fine for the first offense, and I've been talking to Mitch quite a bit trying to get some sort of way on this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that? He mentioned that the fact that it would take food away from the table, the little kids and the shoes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feelings on this? My view is I hit them in a pocketbook. That's why I always get attention to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
What's your personal view on that?
I prefer not to say my personal view on
this. Well, how would you feel about it, for example, hit him in a pocketbook and no jail time the first time, so he keeps him tying down beds?
Mm-hmm. You see, my problem with these questions in general terms, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is the underlying assumption here, and the underlying assumption, I suppose, in all of our criminal statutes, is that there is some type of a deterrent value for firm sentences. And obviously, that's the underlying philosophical belief that underlies, in addition to sort of reaffirmation of community norms. In other words, that's just so rotten that we have to do something to the person. You also have the underlying thing is, well, if the people know that it's a real stiff sentence, they're not going to do it. Any of the police officers you ever talk to, and if you talk to Charlie Smith from Highway Safety or any of those places, the very first facility that leaves you when you start to consume alcohol is your judgment. And followed, that then followed is speech, coordination, memory, recall. So to a certain extent, I'm not sure how realistic the pure deterrence rationale is. I don't think people really think a lot before they commit certain crimes, and I think that this is one of them. When we first put in that 3-day sentence, you know, we're going to put all drunk drivers in for 3 days, there was a drop. If you look at the statistics, there was a drop for a few months in the number of people who were picked up for that offense. And it appeared that, you know, we sort of win in the war on drunk driving. And then, if you look at the statistics, it went back up and leveled out almost about the same offense, or same level, excuse me. And it's that was very discouraging to prosecutors and to people working in the mental health alcohol field, because it called into question our sort of deterrence rationale. And I don't know, to tell you the truth, what deters people and what doesn't. Mr. Bailey believes that license suspension is the most effective deterrent, and he is quite experienced in this area, and that's his personal belief. I think you believe, sir, that hit him in the pocketbook, that that's an effective deterrent. There are other people who think jail time is effective. Perhaps a combination of all of the above is the best. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I can only add one comment to that. My military experience taught me, and I learned this, that to get somebody's attention, you hit them in the pocketbook. If it worked in the military, I don't see why it don't work in the civilian community.
That's
the reason why I asked the question.
Yeah. The other problem, sir, is I think that in the military, you can pass laws and they have some teeth. If a person really doesn't have the money to pay a fine, even if it's a mandatory fine, for all practical purposes, there's nothing that DA or the court can do to make them pay that money. I mean, if they really don't have it, because you cannot imprison them, like say $5 a day or $50 a day to work off the fine. There used to be a provision in Alaska law that says if a person doesn't pay their fine, you imprison them in $5 a day and they work it off. Well, that was struck down by the state Supreme Court as unconstitutional, as penalizing someone for being poor. And just recently there was a decision by the Alaska Court of Appeals, I don't have that in front of me, but I could get that cite for you very easily, that said you couldn't reimpose a suspended sentence on a person for failure to pay the fine unless their failure was willful. In other words, unless they had the money in the bank and they're just thumbing their nose at the court, and the DA could prove that, except for those circumstances, the person could not go to jail because he or she didn't pay the fine. So, to a certain extent, I think why Representative Abboud didn't go to the $50 and the $1,000 and the $1,500 is because he was given a copy of that decision and discussed it with some people and realized that although it might look real well good on paper, if you make them so high that people just don't have the money to pay for them, there's no teeth there to force them. So, in other words, you can't stick them in the pocketbook as much as you'd like to do on paper. And again, I think maybe the Army has a little more freedom in that area.
Let me ask one more question, Mr. Chairman. Okay, all right, if we get an individual here now, the judge is going to slap a $250 fine on him. He doesn't have $250, but he's looking for 15 days in jail on the first offense.
He
can get out of paying a $250 fine if he doesn't have the money. That's what you're telling us.
Yes, sir, unfortunately.
Otherwise, he's home free. You don't have to pay a cent if he hasn't got $250.
The court will do things like tell him, pay $10 a month. I mean, the court will try to work out payments so that he can do it.
All right.
But what I'm saying is, if he's on welfare and he's supporting a family of six kids and he comes in and says, Judge, I just don't have it 6 months later, other than giving him more time to pay, and I'm sure that Mr. Brewer can attest to the fact that it's very frustrating to have people come back in and they have stories and you can't disprove their stories. I mean, you don't know if they were in an auto accident a few months ago, and so it's almost a revolving door sometimes.
Gail, yeah, we need, I hate to hurry you off, but we got Carla Forsythe here who's down from Anchorage and has an airplane to catch. And we have three youngsters here who were at a prior hearing and couldn't get in. And I'd like to, as we are going to recess just till 7 tonight and go from 7 to 10 anyway, at this time I'd like to take you out of towners and the kids that can't come back.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Gail. Carla, could you, at this time, that you could, I didn't ask you which airplane, but if it's pretty soon, while you, since we are recording electronically, before you proceed with your statement, I'll need to have you ask you to state your name for the record again, please.
My name is Carla Forsythe. I'm general counsel to the Alaska court system. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we all recognize that drunk driving is one of the most serious problems facing not only Alaska but the nation today, and it will take a serious commitment to deal with it. There's no question that this sort of legislative approach is going to require additional resources all along the line, in terms of prosecution, in terms of public defenders, and the same holds true for the court. It's not the court's position to comment as to whether a particular legislative approach is good or bad. The only thing that we can try to assist the committee with is a determination as to what sort of impact it will have on the court, what sort of resources will be required from the court to implement this approach. Trying to arrive at some sort of fiscal impact is a very difficult task. If we overestimate, we know we aren't being cost effective. If we underestimate the cost of a program, then we have a program that really doesn't have the effective fiscal and other backup tools to make it run correctly. We have prepared a fiscal note, and I believe each of you should have a copy of this. This fiscal note might be subject to change given some of the comments that Ms. Paretsky just made, some of the revisions that we can anticipate, and perhaps after we have a chance to look at that second committee substitute, we would provide a revised fiscal note. But my comments today will relate to the committee substitute that was available to us. The other is in terms of clerical time. There's one other factor that should be taken into consideration. District courts throughout the state, particularly in our urban locations, already are experiencing substantial increases in caseload filings. Any significant new additions simply cannot be absorbed by the courts in terms of judicial and clerical workload. The areas in which we see an impact are primarily additional hearings. The theory here is that when penalties are increased, more defendants will go to trial rather than plead guilty in an attempt to avoid those more severe penalties. We have made some estimates in our fiscal note. These are just estimates. We based it on a figure of if 5% of those pleading guilty go to trial. In particular, the areas in which we see more hearings are on the basic underlying offense with a stiffer penalty. Also, in the legislation that we reviewed, the provisions for driving while licenses canceled, suspended. In the economic situation that we're faced with these days, where driving is so integral to so many people, this is another example of hitting someone in the pocketbook, and we feel this is going to mean that more people are going to attempt to keep their licenses, and that's simply going to mean more work for the court. And this holds true throughout the legislation, and since it basically is an underlying assumption, I don't think there's any need to tie it into any particular sections, unless someone would like for me to do so specifically. In terms of the additional clerical workload, apart from the judge time, obviously any time a judge is hearing a case, there must be an in-court deputy to make sure that a proper record is being created. There is also clerical backup required to make sure that the paper is processed accurately and speedily. Another area is collection of the mandatory fines. A vigorous collection effort is costly. And some would argue that perhaps the amount of money expended on collecting money from defendants, many of whom are indigent, does not provide a rate of return to the court. This is a policy issue because perhaps there are other goals that we are seeking to serve rather than a straight cost-effective analysis. But it is a fact that a vigorous collection effort on the part of the court does require clerical persons to try to work out payment schedules if that seems to be appropriate, to send out letters, to coordinate with the Attorney General on whatever sort of action should be taken if someone really is going to resist. Section 9 provides for proceedings to be initiated within 7 days of a license seizure. There was some confusion in this provision initially, and Alan Bailey, the Anchorage prosecutor, has been helpful in indicating that his understanding of the intention here is not that hearings be held in 7 days, but the proceedings be initiated. Nonetheless, no matter at what point these hearings are held, that is going to have a greater clerical impact on the court in terms of calendaring, subpoenaing, getting the witnesses together, getting the proceedings set up. A final area of clerical concern, and perhaps this is something that the Department of Law will be addressing, is in the section dealing with the remission of forfeiture hearings. right now, that section 2835038 provides that the court shall provide notice to persons with ownership or security interests. This is not a role that is normally performed by the court. That a notification role is normally something that's up to a moving party. And we would submit that that is a task that should fall with the district attorney, who it appears from what Ms. Horetsky was saying, we'll have that information anyway, that that would be a more efficient use of resources and would also be more in comportment with the court's traditional role as an impartial adjudicator. The bottom line of our analysis is that with the provisions that we had an opportunity to review, we think we're looking at two judges, one for Anchorage, one for Fairbanks. There will be an impact throughout the state, but those are the major locations at which we would see a problem. Palmer and Kenai are also seeing real caseload increases. They're both on major highways. There are going to be problems there as well. And as I say, when we have an opportunity to look at the next version of this bill, perhaps we will be putting in a fiscal note that is somewhat decreased.
Where's Abe Liska?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Forsyth, I have a hard time realizing digesting this fiscal note that apparently you have helped me put it together.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm familiar with the fiscal note.
Okay. How many hours a day now is the court system operating now in the sentencing and hearing our drunk and driving? 8 hours a day? 8 hours a day? Is that all we're working now?
We are, in response to that question, it is an 8-hour day. I think it would be a misrepresentation to say that there are judges on, that every judge is on the bench hearing cases and sentencing 8 hours a day, because as I'm sure Judge Brewer can elucidate on this, there are other functions involved that are not on the bench functions.
Now we're looking at here $646,000 for fiscal year 85, $539,084. And you're talking about hiring two more judges to handle all these cases?
Yes, sir. That would be the impact, what we believe would be warranted in these figures.
You feel we're going to have that many more drunken drivers picked up, you have to have two more judges then?
Yes.
And somebody's not doing a job out there now to hear. I don't know where the backlog is. I don't see your line of reasoning on this amount for a fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, if I might...
Did I lose you?
No, this is a very substantial fiscal note. We feel looking at the fiscal notes submitted by the Department of Law, and I believe that you'll be receiving a fiscal note from the Public Defender's Office that, if not out of line with the sort of increases that they would expect as well. And again, our assumption, and I have to admit, it is only an assumption, is that the stiffer penalties, the stepped-up enforcement effort, the efforts all the way down the line are going to mean more drivers are going to be picked up going into court, and because they stand more to lose, more people will be challenging the drunk driving charge and will be doing so more vigorously, and this is just simply going to take up more court time.
Of course, if it all works properly, you'll have less drunken drivers and the impact will be negative.
Mr. Chairman, that is the thrust from which we started out in analyzing this, that it is a serious problem, and the belief would be that we have to commit some serious resources to deal with it in a way that really is going to make a dent.
Representative Clarkson.
Well, I just want to follow up on Representative Liska's question, and I don't necessarily want to answer this foresight, but basically, as I read the fiscal note, there's three areas that are going to cause the increased effort. First of all, the fact that more people are going to ask for a trial rather than just pleading innocent or pleading guilty, and they estimate 5% of it. That seems to make sense to me. I mean, if I knew now that what it meant was 3 days in jail, that's one thing, but if it means 3 days in jail, $250 fine, and losing my car, I might be more likely to ask for a trial. So I think there is some reasoning behind why more people would do it. The second thing is when you get your license taken away at the scene, you have 7 days to go in and ask for a temporary license. Basically, seems to me a lot of people are going to want to do that. They're going to want to have a license until they come to trial. So a lot of people are going to do that. I think that's justified. The one I'm not so sure why there would be 500 hearings is this remission of interest in the motor vehicle. I guess I don't understand that procedure. Why do you think there's going to be 500 hearings
on the remission of forfeiture. That isn't going to happen that. Doesn't seem to me that's going to happen that often. It's page 15 of the bill again. Your fiscal note says you estimate an additional 500 hearings a year for petitions for remission of interest in a motor vehicle.
Well, again, this, Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to Representative Clarkson, I understand what he's driving at, and I also think that in terms of some of the changes that Ms. Koretsky indicated, that we will be seeing fewer of these. She testified that the forfeiture will be a remedy only in the most drastic cases. The assumption in this note was that that's going to be a remedy that's going to be sought very frequently in terms of these cases, and that appears not to be the case. So this is an area that I'm assuming that we will see some sort of decrease.
And I think when they did start, they were talking about taking it away.
Yeah, a lot more. Right. But I think the first two areas, there's every reason to think that that is going to go up. There's going to be more court hearings and trials.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to that, and maybe clarify my mind the way of thinking. How much more law enforcement can we have now than we have right today? I mean, we're going to have to put the Anchorage Police Department, for that, is going to have to beef itself up. The state troopers are going to have to beef themselves up. I don't see that in the budget beefing anybody up. So, I don't see where we're going to get all these people at all at once. They have to get two judges up there.
I think what he's trying to say is that he feels that the same trial is going to go on, except that the sentence at the end of it is going to be different, and why should it cost more to change a few words?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's what I'm trying to put
in. I think the argument is more people are going to ask for trials when it gets the more penalty areas, or more people aren't going to be interested in pleading guilty.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what's the backlog now of people asking for trials? Do you have information on
Representative Liska there? In the court system, that's phrased in terms of a trailing calendar, which means that cases that are coming in are not being currently scheduled. And because these are criminal cases, these are cases that must be tried within 120. And there is no backlog in this area. Things are progressing along in a relatively smooth fashion. But that's given the workload that there is right now, and particularly in the Anchorage District Court. That court is working at capacity. The problem is that any new addition in trials is going to bring that court over where it is right now in terms of what the judges are doing.
Of course, no, I'm just trying to get some answers to satisfy my mind. You understand what I'm saying? Thank you.
Representative Foxy.
Well, but you do make one good point, which I don't see a fiscal note from the Department of Law here talking about more prosecutors. There is a fiscal note from the troopers, but it's pretty low. It doesn't look like they're going to put too many more troopers on. The question arises then, if there aren't any more troopers on the road to arrest these people, and if there aren't any more prosecutors to prosecute them, then why is there more, I guess that's more of a question for why there aren't more prosecutors rather than why the court system is so high.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Representative Liska's question, I noticed in this forfeiture motor vehicle section, one of the reasons, if there's a second offense, either for an EWI, and if they have previously been convicted, then the court can forfeit the vehicle either for DWI or for refusal to submit the chemical test. And with the more excessive penalties, there will probably be very quickly a lot more people refusing the chemical test if the prosecuting attorneys get into the posture of requiring forfeiture because of that. Then Ms. Forsyth's projections are going to be much more justified because they can do an awful lot of forfeitures. And the way this forfeiture section is read, the court can do a lot of forfeitures, which would in turn require a lot more hearings for the remission of forfeitures in the next section. So it could demand quite a bit more court time, conceivably, not necessarily, but conceivably.
Let me just continue on my point, I guess. If we're going to enforce this, we're going to need more cops and more prosecutors to put them through the system. If we aren't going to do that, fine. Then maybe Ms. Forsyth's fiscal note is overstated. But I would submit that we have to look at the fiscal impact on the troopers and on the prosecutors, because that's how they're going to get into the court system.
Is the Department of Law anticipating the cost, additional costs as a result of this legislation? Do we know that?
Well, Gail was just here.
We might check on that.
I think what she said when she was here that I don't know if you were here when she's talking about working up this whole rework. And at that time, she would then have a fiscal note to match the new bill. So we're kind of at a disadvantage not having the new bill or a fiscal note from the Department of Law, which may well answer some of the questions you brought out here.
Maybe I was misreading the testimony of the fiscal note, but in response to Representative Clarkson, it seems to me that what we're talking about is we're talking about more hearings and more trials as a result of the change in the penalties, not necessarily more cases coming into the court. There may be more of those too, I suppose, but that's the way I read it here. They talk about 6,000 DWI, 8.6% go to trial. They say maybe 5% of those pleading guilty will go. You could talk about that. And then the additional hearings that may be required by other sections of legislation. So, I mean, I don't think we're talking about a lot more troopers or a lot more prosecutors, but we probably are talking about more hearings, more trials. But I don't know. This is a guess, I guess, but I mean, I think the argument seemed to be pulled together. I don't know if the numbers do.
Since we are kind of running down towards time, I'd like to thank you much for coming down.
Let me just pin that down if I can. Okay. I think I may have to withdraw everything I say. And it's based on a question of what your assumptions were in the preparation of the fiscal note. Did you assume more arrests, or did you just assume more people pleading not guilty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clarkson, the primary assumption is more people pleading guilty. I believe, I do not have a copy of it, and I could be totally off base, but I believe there is a Department of Law fiscal note which indicates that there will be additional prosecutorial resources, perhaps in relation to Senate Bill 61. And I could be wrong because there's other legislation relating to liability insurance. But I believe there is a fiscal note, but since that's nothing that appears on the surface of the bill, that I have to say that our underlying assumption is the increase in trials due to the guilty pleas, but the 5% figure seems to be low.
Not guilty pleas.
Correct. But we've had a note here from her, and she's taken it back. I think in her testimony today, she said it will be redrawn when they get the whole thing redrawn. Thank you, Carla, for coming down.
What's that you said, Joe?
Thank you,
not
Mr.
guilty
Chairman.
Pleas, it's not guilty pleas.
There will be more guilty pleas. She really meant to say there will be more not guilty.
I know what you meant.
I didn't phrase it very well. Yeah, right.
I hope I don't mispronounce it. Is it Tanya Franny? I beg your pardon?
Training.
Or Training. I can't see that exactly. I beg your pardon? Well, she owns all three, and only she is going to. Okay. Thanks for joining us today. Since we are recording electronically, I have to have you state your name for the record and then proceed with your statement.
Okay. My name is Tanya Training, and I go to Madrid, junior high. I'm in with a high school group called SWAP, which is Students with a Purpose. And so I guess that's what I'm representing. We've been doing a lot of research on House Bill 6, and I've talked to the vice president of MAD, his wife, and June Garish is on her way down today. So after I talk to them, I'll know a little bit more. But from what I can tell right now, as far as my group is concerned, we're all in agreement with the bill. There's something needs to be done about the drunk driving, and because we know of a couple kids that, some friends of ours that were hurt in an auto accident not long ago from drunk driving, and so there's something that needs to be done about it. Section 1 on the alcohol awareness is one that we can, we understand a lot, because we feel that if people know what's going to happen to them, what the consequences are going to be, and how much alcohol they can handle without being legally drunk, then that's going to prevent kids my age and that are applying for the license, that may prevent some of them from drinking and taking the risk if they know what's going to happen to them. An example we could use is, okay, at our school we had a problem with chewing tobacco, which is kind of off the subject, that kids were chewing and they weren't supposed to, but nobody was notified of it. So when the laws were or when, well, the rules of the school were changed, they stated them beforehand, handed everybody the paper and was notified of it. And it really worked. It cut down on it at all, took it all out. So I think by using alcohol awareness, if you know what can happen, you're not gonna do it most likely. Also, there's, I don't know if you were handed the, it was called drunk driving penalties in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that one? Yeah. Well, if you can see, Israel, they, a spokesman for them was quoted that saying that there was only one drunk driving case a year. So they must have, something's under control. And so if they can toughen their laws, I think we should be able to. I think that we could even go tougher. I can understand how come we're not, but I think it's great that they're restricting the laws even more.
Thank you. Are there questions of Claudia or Representative Fox?
One of the things that we have the toughest time with, of course, is, and you heard the earlier testimony, is trying to figure out what it is that stops people from drinking and driving. One thing you've said, of course, is knowing ahead of time that it's illegal. That's point number one. But there are several things you can do, and you've heard us talk about this. You can impose a fine. You can hit them in the pocketbook if they drink and drive. Or you can put them in jail if they drink and drive. Or you can take their license away, or you can take their car away. Just from the position of you and your friends, which of those would be the most effective in convincing you and your friends not to drink and drive?
I think taking the license away. I think that knowing that you wouldn't be able to drive again, that would get me, because look at how many kids have a lot of friends. You know, they have enough money that if they're going to laugh about, you know, $200. And a jail sentence, they don't instruct them, or they don't follow through with them always on kids. They figure this is only their first offense, we'll let them off. And so I think taking the license away is the bigger thing that you can do to a teenager.
Thank you.
How many folks are there in the...
I think there's probably about 30, and a couple more were coming up today but couldn't get out of class.
David, how old is this organization?
It's pretty new. I think it's only maybe even 2 years old, even not even that.
But it is 2 years.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah. That's been
that one. You may not want to tell you this, but how old are you?
I'm 15.
15. Mm-hmm. Are most of the kids of this group about this age?
No, most of them are seniors.
Mm-hmm. Why? How did you start? What started you?
Well, I was. We had Nancy Seymour. She's in charge of the alcohol abuse and drug abuse council here in Juneau. And she set up something through school, and I met her through that, and she said, well, why don't you join in on this if you enjoy doing it?
Interesting. Representative Liska?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I tell you one thing, I'd like to thank you young folks for coming over and putting your input into this. You mentioned to Representative Clarkson that you felt the biggest impact would be suspension of license.
Mm-hmm.
How would you feel, I'll ask you a question now, how would you feel, for example, your age group type, which, you know, we're attempting to get the age 21 drinking under age 21. At your age, normally you don't have a case, anything, you are not involved in police work or anything, you don't see these bad crashes where they carry them out, and they're pretty gory. Do you think that'll be effective, for example, with the programs? We're putting the fact by the Division of Public Safety or something like that to show some types of what actually happens in some of these types of, because of drunk driving here. I mean, you just mentioned suspension of licenses would probably be the biggest impact on keeping somebody from drinking. How do you feel about that? I mean, you think it'd be effective, the programs, for example, where they say, we have on medical, different things, you know, and the results of some of these real gory accidents.
You mean on TV or something?
Well, yes, or okay. Regular training programs in your SWAT.
I think that'd be really effective if they could, I know there was a boy, I think in Iowa, I'm not sure where he lived, but he had killed a girl, and he got up and spoke in front of the school and just told about, he was drunk and he killed the girl, and he got up and spoke. Is that your question?
Yeah, it was effective to you, then, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Coxon.
If I can change the subject a little bit, although it is really the same subject, I'd like to hear what you think about increasing the drinking age to 21.
Just kidding.
And I really want to know in terms of the effect that would have on your friends, you and your friends.
Okay. Well, I can see that, this is just personally what I know, I haven't researched this. I think that it should be raised because, I hate to say this, but kids are going, if the laws are at 19, they're probably going to start drinking at 16 or 17. And if it's raised to 21, if they're going to drink illegally, they'll wait later until maybe they're 18. That's what I can see. I think that it should be raised.
Good answer. Thank you very much. There are no further questions for coming down. And I know you sat here patiently last time we had the hearing, and we just ran out of time. And I really appreciate you coming back.
Thank you.
We are going to take up a teleconference tonight. If you want to come down and listen to testimony from statewide issues, there will be people from all over. And we start at 7 tonight here. If you'd like to come back, we'd be happy to have you here. You can sit and listen to them. Perhaps you need to lift a little distance before you find yourself happy.
Okay.
If there's nothing further to come, Representative Cox.
Let me ask you what's going to happen on Monday. Obviously, there are some very complicated changes to the bill. Are you expecting that the bill will move on Monday?
I was just as surprised as you were at Representative Abood's statement there. I chair the committee, not him, and I chose to just kind of ignore that. I'm not prepared to answer that because I don't know what's going to happen Monday with that. But as far as I know, until we get something drafted up, and as you can see, Ms. Oretzky was a little bit surprised too. So when we get it in our hands and know what we're going to do with it, I guess we'll decide, of course, actually at that time. So if there's nothing further coming for us right now, we'll stand in recess until 7 tonight. 2 p.m., and the date is the 14th of April, and we'll reconvene the House Judiciary Committee.
House Bill 6,
and act relating to driving a vehicle.
The meeting, and I'll turn it over to him, Representative Bussell.
The Committee on Judiciary has reconvened. The matter at issue today is House Bill 6, an act relating to driving a motor vehicle. The purpose of the evening teleconference was to expand the record with information concerning that issue. And we are ready to accept testimony from those on the teleconference network. I understand Alan Bailey is in Anchorage. And if you're ready to testify now, Alan, we're ready to take your statement. Since we are recording electronically, I'll need you to state your name prior to making your statement.
They consist of the charges filed by the Anchorage Police Department. I have been a prosecutor for approximately 9 years, and one of the top two priority items in my agency is the prosecution of drunk drivers. I think House Bill 6 has, as some people have said, something to offend everyone. It also has some things that can do a lot of good, I think, in the future for the people of the state. Obviously, the enhanced punishment provisions are just that. They are punishment. They are a measure of society's condemnation for this dangerous driving offense. I have long favored stiffer sentences than many judges have given out, although some judges in the state have given many sentences I feel were warranted and right in the good, the proper range. I think the committee should know, if it doesn't already, that enhanced jail provisions for any offense, even if it's a misdemeanor and even if the enhancement is only a few days, will have the effect of raising the rate at which certain misdemeanors go to trial, particularly in an area like this where, in Anchorage, for instance, the majority of the drunk drivers who do not plead guilty at arraignment, the first court appearance, are represented by either the public defender agency or one of the union prepaid legal plans, so that the defendant can go to trial without spending any money out of his pocket. So there will be a cost to the public of demonstrating the public's disapproval of this conduct. There are some real benefits to the public in this bill as well. My priorities for those are, number one, the administrative suspension of or administrative revocation of licenses for persons who either refuse to take a breath test or take a breath test and have a result of 0.10 or more. The provisions in this bill were more or less tailored after the Minnesota state statutes under which police officers observing either a 0.10 breath test reading or a breath test refusal take the driver's license then and there as an agent for the State Department of Public Safety, provide the defendant with a piece of paper that says that it is a temporary license and will expire in 7 days unless the subject initiates an administrative or court proceeding to rescind the revocation. I left the administrative proceeding was left out of this provision because it did not seem to be necessary, since the ability to stop the revocation by filing a court action within 7 days of the arrest would seem to satisfy the Alaska Supreme Court's statement in Graham versus State that you cannot deprive a person of his property interest without an opportunity for a prior hearing. I would add that the U.S. Supreme Court has characterized implied consent revocation as such a reliable proceeding, at least it's based on reliable factual findings, such that a prior hearing is not required. In the Mackey versus Mondrum case, the implied consent revocation system in Massachusetts was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, even though the defendant's license was revoked prior to an opportunity for a hearing. This specific issue has not been litigated in Alaska, and it might well be that the Supreme Court would not require that. In any event, House Bill 6 does provide this kind of protection for the defendant's due process rights and avoids that kind of a constitutional problem, in my opinion. Another case approving a different type of license revocation prior to a hearing was the Dixon versus Love case from the U.S. Supreme Court. There are a couple of things that the administrative revocation does that are helpful, in my opinion. One of them is that it provides provides a punishment at the time of the crime, or almost at the time of the crime, and this has an outstanding psychological effect. And since we're talking about behavior modification in any attempt to deter drinking drivers from repeating their offenses, the bringing the punishment to the time of the transgression is really much more effective than the present system under which a defendant can stall license action or any other punishment for months, sometimes years, in the criminal justice system simply by exercising all of his rights, filing a host of motions, and hiring the right lawyer to think up innovative legal attacks on just about anything. Another thing this type of administrative revocation would do is eliminate the problem that we have with implied consent revocation. In fact, all administrative revocations at present, that is the problem that we have a transient population in Alaska. They move around a lot. They don't notify the state of address changes. And so mailed notices of suspension or revocation, in my experience, usually do not find their mark. Despite the statutory validity of such notices, the courts have said that even though the statute presumes service upon certified mailing and a return unserved or unclaimed, a return undeliverable or unclaimed, we're going to impose on that an additional requirement that the licensee knew or should have known that his license was revoked. So by having the officer notice the defendant at the time, right after his breath test refusal or breath test results, that his license is revoked, you eliminate the mailed notice provision. Another difficulty with mailed notices is that it's as many as with many lawbreakers, people who are problem drinkers and who repeat in drunk driving, they're not going to pick up a piece of certified mail. When the postman sets it on the counter at the post office, the driver can look at it and see that the return address is the State Department of Public Safety. He does not have to accept that certified mail, and it will be returned unclaimed. And there again, we have the notice problem. So this type of administrative revocation, with the officer acting as an agent of the Department of Public Safety, solves that problem. It has been suggested that this kind of provision might well take away some of the court's discretion. Now, it was drafted so as to avoid doing just that. It instead relieves the court of one of its obligations in sentencing, but it does not affect the provisions of AS 2815-181. So it therefore does not remove the judge's discretion to revoke the license for an additional period should a particular defendant or his record or the aggravated case warrant a longer revocation than is provided by 181. It merely provides a floor revocation that the judge has got to do anyway under present law, so it doesn't really affect the judge's discretion. In fact, at present, the judge has no discretion to undercut the statutory period, and this would, of course, not change that. It would merely allow the judge in sentencing a DWI defendant who, for instance, had his license revoked administratively for 1 year. In an aggravated case, the judge might well want to revoke it for 2, 3, or 5 years, or longer. So the provisions of this bill would, in my opinion, enhance the judge's powers without taking away from them. In another sense, the administrative revocation is going to impose a, in my opinion, a very modest additional fiscal burden on the Department of Public Safety. But in my opinion, it will remove some of the burden from the district court's trial calendar. It's been my experience that many second offenders were faced with a one-year license revocation and paid 10 days in jail. Are more concerned about that one-year license revocation than the jail time. If they're driving for a living, they're a taxi driver or a truck driver or a heavy equipment operator, they're not going to be able to stall that revocation by legal maneuvers. They're not going to be able to beat it by putting on a dog and pony show for a jury and conning the jury. And so the effect on the trial calendar will be to, I think, enhance the change of plea rate on second offenses. If a person really believes that there's not an not a sufficient basis to revoke the license, the defendant can file a petition with the court to review the revocation to see if all the requirements of law were met. And if it isn't done within 7 days, it may not stop the revocation, but if the court comes up with a finding that the revocation was not well-founded, the revocation will be ended right then and there at the court hearing. The experience in Minnesota has been that only a modest number of these rescission hearings have been held, very, very few of them have resulted in a vacation of the license revocation action. There are a couple of problems in the draft of CSHB 6, in my opinion. And I think since I assisted in the drafting of the bill, I would have to take credit for them. In attempting to work into the current statutory scheme, the revocation system used in Minnesota, it was not noticed that the Department of Public Safety is still required on page 7 of the bill, line 6. The Department of Public Safety is required to notify the defendant, the drunk driver, that his license has been suspended. That would seem to that would, if enacted, keep the mail notice requirement and all of its problems, and it would probably result in some courts saying that if that notification didn't reach the defendant, that his revocation is over, that it doesn't exist, that it's invalid. And of course, that's the problem we have now. So that should be changed to read something like, in line 6, license is required, and that the officer has given the person written notice of the suspension or revocation. The Department of Public Safety shall enter into its records the revocation or suspension of the person's license, etc. To merely require that the department formally enter the revocation into its records. On line 22 on page 7, again, since the department is not notifying the defendant, I suppose the department is still the revoking agency. So that could remain as it is presently drafted. I have another in this same problem area on page 10, line 1. We have the same apparent continued requirement for notice by mail, and that should be changed in line 1 to read, public safety shall enter into its records the suspension or revocation of that person's license or non-resident privilege to drive or operate a motor vehicle in the state, period.
Alan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
Have you spoken with Gail Oretzky today or within the last day or so?
Yes, I spoke with her this morning, Mr. Chairman, and it's my understanding that she has taken into account these suggested changes in her impending judiciary committee substitute for the committee substitute.
Yeah, she testified at some length today and went over these matters with us. And by hopefully Monday or Tuesday or first day or two of next week, she hopes to have that drafted to a stage other than an assemblage of notes, which she presented to us today for the changes. So if you care to proceed to go over them, that's fine for the other people on the teleconference network, but it's not necessary for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only other change I had suggested was in on page 13, again, to make sure that we're talking about not a mailed notice, but the officer's hand-delivered notice of revocation, and I think Gail has taken that into account also. I suppose there may be some fiscal impact from the additional jail time provisions in this bill and the impound requirements in the mandatory car impound requirements. And if I had to pick my druthers of baggage I would throw overboard in order to help this sail through the session, it would be to